As a book critic for The Washington Post, Carlos Lozada has read some 150 volumes claiming to diagnose why Trump was elected and what his presidency reveals about our nation. Many of these, he's found, are more defensive than incisive, more righteous than right. In his new book, What Were We Thinking? A Brief Intellectual History of the Trump Era, Lozada uses these books to tell the story of how we understand ourselves in the Trump era, using as his main characters the political ideas and debates at play in America today. He dissects works on the white working class, like Hillbilly Elegy, manifestos from the anti-Trump resistance, like On Tyranny and No Is Not Enough, books on race, gender, and identity, like How to Be an Anti-Racist, and Good and Mad, polemics on the future of the conservative movement, like The Corrosion of Conservatism, and of course, plenty of books about Trump himself. Carlos Lozada's new book is What Were We Thinking? And it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
I love the idea of this book. It seems like a great, just a great pitch. I would think, so at what point did it come together for you to think, oh, this is something that I could really do something with?
It really started accidentally. Back in 2015, when Trump was suddenly riding high in the polls for the Republican nomination, I started reading some of his own old books, even his old ghostwritten books like The Art of the Deal and others, to see what I could make of him. And then suddenly there's all these books coming out about his supporters, and this was the glut of books about the white working class. And then he wins the election, and there's the resistance books. And I suddenly realized that this was going to be my beat at the Washington Post. It wasn't until after the midterm election, when I'd been doing this for a few years, that it came to me that maybe I could try to tackle these books collectively, try to see what they were saying and what they revealed about us as sort of a genre. I wanted to see how our best thinkers were trying to grapple with Trumpism in real time. So that's where this book comes from.
So you write, America's intellectuals have done what many of us do in times of crisis and disorientation. They have retrenched to their comfort zones, finding solace in old arguments, familiar enemies, instinctive outbursts, and easy certainties. Individually, the books of the Trump era try to show a way forward. Collectively, they reveal how we are stuck. That's a beautiful way of saying some of these books aren't that great.
Well, I think that there's wonderful books in the mix. What I do think you see a lot of is writers who were so shocked at the rise of Trump. And frankly, I mean, it's not just them. Sort of not many people really thought that he was going to win. It's not clear that even the Trump campaign thought they had a chance at winning. And so when something like that happens, there is an immediate need to make sense of it. And what do? You end up relying on ways that you've understood the world previously and trying to make this event fit into it. One thing you see a lot is writers saying, oh, this just proves everything I've been arguing for a long time. You know, Trump is the culmination of all the forces that I've been thinking about for years. And you see that in a book like No Is Not Enough by Naomi Klein. You see it in a book as different as Audience of One by the New York Times television critic, who sees Trump as a TV character, as the sort of ultimate anti-hero in the mold of Tony Soprano. And so you also see a lot of writers who simply start preaching to their own choirs, who, whether because they're with Trump or they're against Trump, try to close everyone else out and just speak to their own communities.
I want to get back to your particular book, but this even came out before, or it was finished by you before this most recent spate, right? I mean, we have had over the last, during this election time, from the conventions to now, just dozens and dozens of books added to this, and one more high profile than the other.
Yes, I was just because of our deadlines for publishing the book, I had to wrap it up over the summer. And there have been many books that have come out since, including some very revealing and high profile. The one that I may regret missing the most being able to address in my book is Mary Trump's book,
right.
Trump's niece, who wrote a sort of family memoir of her experience growing up Trump. And that was really a wonderful book to my mind. I wrote about it for the Washington Post, but I wasn't able to include it in the book because it's such a unique perspective. She is able to not just give you the vantage point of a close relative who saw this family, you know, her whole life, but also as a trained psychologist. I mean, that's an extraordinary combination to with which to assess the Trump family. A lot of folks have been sort of psychoanalyzing Trump from afar. She's able to do it up close.
One of the things that often comes with these books, I know we heard it with the John Bolton book, even back to the Jim Comey book. We heard it with whoever has the goods, if you will, on the president. What strikes me about them in having either have read them and talked to the authors or have read about them is that none of it is really surprising. And I think that is a fascinating aspect. And one of the things that you talk about in your book is the books that actually, and you do name several, that are actually saying something, that they're not just telling us what we already know, or maybe some juicy gossip or anecdote that they have that they heard firsthand, but something that will actually also tell us, okay, but what can we do with this information?
I think that's right. I should say, far be it from me to turn away the juicy Washington gossip. I will happily read those books, and books like Comey's book and John Bolton's book certainly deliver plenty of that. They can also be very self-serving. I mean, no one's a secondary character in the story of their own life. You know, everyone is the hero and
right.
And kind of place themselves in. At the center of the action, but I would agree that one thing I've concluded reading these books is that the most essential and useful books of the Trump era are really not about Trump at all. They're not the insider tell-alls, however entertaining or deeply reported those may be. They are the books that place Trump in the long arc of the American story. Books like America for Americans by Erica Lee, a historian, who writes about how the tradition of America as a nation of immigrants has coexisted right alongside a tradition of American xenophobia and the rejection of outsiders. And those things go together. A book like One Person, No Vote by Carol Anderson that looks at the long history of struggle for voting rights and the scourge of voting suppression. A book like America for Americans by Joe Lepore, which interrogates those self-evident truths of the Declaration of Independence and finds that more often than not, we've not really been able to live up to those founding documents. So I think Trump is unique only to the extent that he combines all these debates all at once in a single person. But those books that make him more understandable in the American context, I find to be especially useful.
One of the ones that you mentioned that I found fascinating because I thought it was terrific was Michael Lewis's The Fifth Risk, because he's looking at those across the federal government and not what's happening in the White House, but looking at the agencies, looking at the bureaucrats, and how they're being impacted. And as we go through a pandemic right now, that is very, very prophetic.
That is an extraordinary book. Michael Lewis, of course, is really well known for his huge blockbusters like The Big Short or Moneyball or
right.
The Blind Side that all become great movies and the like. This book, or a Michael Lewis book was a little quieter. I didn't even know it was coming until it arrived at the Post newsroom. But I think it is able to offer almost a countercultural perspective right now, when there's so much fighting and debates over the deep state and over, you know, the Obama holdovers who are getting in the way of the Trump agenda, as the Trump administration likes to say. This shows how day to day people who work in the federal government are trying to prevent major crises and catastrophes and are basically in the business of risk management. It was published before the pandemic, but he even mentions the notion of a pandemic being precisely the sort of problem, a thorny, wickedly complicated problem that these agencies are set up to fight. And what I really liked about it is that he picks three cabinet agencies, but didn't go with the big ones, didn't go with defense or the State Department or the Treasury, but instead really got us into the weeds, the Department of Agriculture and Commerce and Energy, and showed us what they really do. It's sort of a love letter to the federal workforce.
Carlos Lozada is our guest. He is a Pulitzer Prize winner and a book reviewer for The Washington Post. His new book, What We Were Thinking, A Brief Intellectual History of the Trump Era, and again, the nonfiction book critic of The Washington Post. You start off Chapter 8, The Chaos Chronicles, by saying, I blame Michael Wolff. Michael Wolff, of course, famously for the book Fire and Fury. Why do you blame him?
So I remember where I was when Michael Wolff's Fire and Fury came out. It was this sensation. I had to stay up all night reading it and crank out a review the next morning very quickly, because this was the first of what has become a major genre of the Trump years, which is the insider look, the tell-all about all the mayhem in the Trump White House. And it had all these unbelievable exchanges and moments, and became a huge media sensation and sold insanely well. And I think that it kind of set a template for a lot of Trump books to come, even to my mind, better ones that just evolved into this competition for who would have the craziest anecdote or the most over-the-top metaphor. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think people like to know what's going on, even if by this point there's a sort of shocking but not surprising quality to the Trump White House. But my fear is that that approach in some ways undercut some of the really good reporting that exists in these various books. People are so focused on the salacious details that they miss out some more significant revelations. For instance, the book by my two colleagues at the Washington Post, Phil Rucker and Carol Lenig, their book, A Very Stable Genius,
right,
got plenty of attention for those just crazy moments. You know, there's a scene where Trump has to read portions of the Constitution and just stumbles over the words. He can't do it, which, of course, is like this huge metaphor alert, right? And yet that book, for instance, is where I first learned that Robert Mueller's team, after completing their much-awaited report, just passed up on the opportunity to review the letter that Attorney General Barr was going to issue summarizing the report, which, of course, after the fact ended up being what looks like a distortion of the report's conclusions. And that seems like a big deal. That seems like a major missed opportunity on the part of the Mueller team. That's the kind of revelation that I didn't really see reflected in the breathless news coverage of the book. It's the same with Bob Woodward's Rage. It got a lot of attention for the endless conversations and interviews between Woodward and Trump. But the first half of the book is told through the eyes of major national security officials in the Trump administration. and shows the degree to which they were really terrified and concerned about a possible nuclear conflict with North Korea. And, you know, that, again, is the kind of thing that just got a lot less attention.
You write about books. For the most part, I agree with you on most of these books. One that I really liked that you had issue with was Arlie Hochschild's book. And I'm interested in what you made of that. The thing that I thought was interesting about it was that it was one of the first that I had read. It came out right before the election of 2016. She was actually going in to look into Louisiana and looking into the Tea Party as to what was happening 5 years or so before, and saw some of this, and so the Trump election did not surprise her so much. How did you take those books? And I guess to bring out the question a little bit, not only that, but to take a look at some of these books that were early on and came out as it was happening, if you will.
Yes. So I was kind of alone in my view on that book. That book, a lot of people had the same reaction that you did, and the book was very well reviewed and highly acclaimed. It was a finalist for the National Book Award. So I absolutely accept that I had a minority view on Strangers in Their Own Land, which was the name of that book. My concern with it is that I felt that the author came to the exercise with a lot of sort of pre-cooked and preconceived notions. And the vibe I got reading it is that there were moments of the author's condescension toward her subjects. But again, I fully recognize that I was certainly not the consensus view on that. It was a book, as you say, that came out early. And several of these books emerged in 2016 and became, in hindsight, extremely relevant. The ultimate example of that is Hillbilly Elegy by J.D. Vance,
right,
which is not a Trump book, does not even mention Donald Trump, was written before Trump's campaign, and yet became a Trump book, became a prism through which both left and right tried to understand the Trump voter. And of course, J.D. Vance has become a significant voice, especially in conservative circles since then. A book such as Heartland by Sarah Smarsh did something similar, but more from the left than from the right. So I think it's a good book to pair and read perhaps opposite J.D. Vance. And the last thing I'll say on that glut of books that came out about the white working class is that they often bifurcated the debate over the Trump voter, the sort of, you know, industrial Midwest heartland Trump voter, into a question of, well, are they motivated by prejudice, or are they motivated by their economic struggles, as if those can be the only two options, the only two reasons why anyone does anything, and as if those can't go together sometimes. And I found that some of these books would rely too heavily on one or the other explanation, depending, in fact, on how they viewed Trump's appeal overall. The book that I found especially useful from that group was one that got relatively less attention, called We're Still Here by Jennifer Silva. And what she saw is that rather than pushing them to one candidate or another, these struggles often left them feeling there was no room in the political system for them at all. She was interviewing her subjects on election day, and she shows up with her I voted sticker. You know, she's in Pennsylvania, coal country. And the people she was interviewing for the book saw her sticker and just mocked her. They laughed at her for thinking, for being so naive as to think that the political system would be responsive to her views, because that's how they felt about it. And that's the moment that really stayed with me.
My final question to you is one that I had the great honor of interviewing David Halberstam and David McCullough together, and they were talking about the difference between writing contemporary history and writing history, and what it was like, especially for Halberstam, to write history as it was happening. With that in mind, what do you think the future books will be like, and will they be as telling? Because context, obviously, adds a tremendous amount.
I look forward to those future books. People often ask me, oh, you must be so sick of these books. Are you ready to go on to something else? I can't wait to read future histories of this period. I imagine that the best books of the Trump era have yet to be written. There are memoirs that I can't wait to read. You know, I hope Anthony Fauci writes a memoir. I hope Don McGahn, the former White House counsel in the Trump White House, writes a memoir. I hope Kirstjen Nielsen, who was at the center of all these major controversies over family separation at the border through her perch at Homeland Security, I hope she tells the story. And again, I imagine that these histories, as new documents are declassified, as new investigations are held, will reveal so much more than we know today. I don't think that the books that we have now are so definitive as eventually they will be seen to be. But I think that's all right. I think that what I've tried to do in this book is just capture a snapshot of thinking in a particular moment, how we wrestled with Trump and Trumpism in real time.
The name of the new book is What Were We Thinking? A Brief Intellectual History of the Trump Era by Carlos Lozada. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Carlos, what a great pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the new book is What Were We Thinking? Published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.